You're listening to the MoneyWeb Now podcast series with Simon Brown. Live streamed every weekday at 6:30 a.m.
It's Thursday, 11 December. The Fed cut 0.25% last night, and they announced a $40 billion a month buying of treasury bills. QE is back. I'm Simon Brown, coming at you live and loud from the MoneyWeb Global Headquarters in Johannesburg, South Africa. On the show today, Sean Coverville. He's from Anchor. They've been putting out their best stock picks for 2026. We'll ask him for a local and one offshore as well. We're going to be chatting with PMX on the challenges of forecasting and what investors should focus on instead. And Victor Gimeshuizen from ABSA CIB. Bitvest really recently did a Euro bond issue, which 5.5 times oversubscribed. I want to dig into those details. This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more global opportunities through their partnership with JP Morgan Asset Management. Morning headlines, MoneyWeb, a unit trust with 6% fees. Investors in this household name pay handsomely for performance. Business Day, Mr. Price's 9.6 billion rand NKD buy marks bold pivot into Europe's 280 billion euro retail market. Tests global ambitions, raise questions over profitability. Market didn't like, stock down 14%. Morning markets, US was green, S&P 0.7% higher, NASDAQ up 0.4%. The East is mostly actually mixed. We've got Sydney down 0.7%. We've got Tokyo up 0.1%. We've got Hong Kong down 2 points and Tencent up 0.25%. Commodities mixed. Gold futures, 4,268. Brent, 62.21. The PGMs are red. Platinum, 1,678. Palladium, 1,517. The Rand, 16.92. Bitcoin, 89,700. Top 40, red open expected, minus 280 points, little over 0.25%.
MoneyWeb Now, on the money. Also available on podcast.
Chatting now with Sean Coverwell from Anchor. Sean, appreciate the early morning time. As I said in the intro, Anchor have been putting out their picks for next year, the offshore and a local. Let's start with a local stock. As I understand, there's five per each. We'll just touch on one of them of your choice, which is the local one you're bringing to us this morning.
Thanks, Simon. I will chat about Premier. Premier Group. So Premier is unusual in that it hasn't been listed for very long and was recently unbundled by investment holding company Brait.
Yeah.
But while it was private and under the stewardship of Brait, the group invested heavily in its manufacturing and distribution system, sort of at a time when competitors like Target Brands and Pioneer, which is now under the ownership of Pepsi, were seemingly asleep at the wheel. So over time, Premier carved itself out as the Shoprite, I would say, of milling and baking under its flagship brand, Blue Ribbon. So Blue Ribbon's posted industry-leading volume growth, sort of implying the group is gaining good market share. And now while I think they will continue to take market share from the likes of Pioneer Sasco, I think Albany should put up more of a fight given Tigers being run by Chart, Kruger and Co., who we respect highly. Just to switch to the earnings profile, so since listing, Premier has grown earnings at a very strong double-digit rate, and that growth comes down to three simple factors: a bit of revenue growth, operating margin expansion, and falling finance costs, given the group has been paying down debt from its break days. We think those three factors will continue in the year ahead, but a key driver being a step change in operating margins underpinned by the opening of this Eraton mega bakery. So
yeah,
Eraton has been open since November and allows the company to consolidate its regional manufacturing footprint by mothballing its three older bakeries. But so that will bring down the cost to transport bread from other facilities. But Eraton will also improve their service delivery. So over previous festive seasons, like the one we're in now, Premier hasn't really been able to meet the demand for Blue Ribbon. But with Eraton open, hopefully that bottleneck should ease. So maybe just to switch to longer term, obviously they've put forward the acquisition of Rhodes. And two of our longstanding concerns with the Premier investment case have been limited liquidity in its shares and concentration to milling and baking. Consolidating Rhodes sort of addresses both while also improving earnings immediately given the multiple they paid. So we view Premier as a best-in-class operator with a very strong growth trajectory, trading on what we think is a reasonable multiple of 14 times.
Yeah, and great prospects, absolutely. I think I agree with you on Rhodes, and that new bakery is going to be a fundamental game changer for them. So Premier locally, what's the offshore one you're going to be picking?
So our offshore one is the London Stock Exchange, or LSEG. So LSEG enters 2026 in an unusual position of being a premium data and analytics business. Prices, though, were far more cyclical. So it's trading about a 20 times PE multiple, which is well below 30 times multiples you see on global peers like S&P Global and Moody's.
Mm-hmm.
So why the discounts? So we think there's an outdated perception that LSEG is being viewed as a pure exchange operator. Now, exchange services contributes less than a quarter of total group revenue. And in effect, we believe the market is sort of anchoring to the wrong part of the earnings base. In our eyes, the fundamental drivers of value are its data analytics and workflow platforms. These are great businesses, higher quality, mm-hmm. recurring, protected by deep competitive moats. And just on that point about recurring revenue, 70% of LSEG's revenue qualifies as recurring, and LSEG has demonstrated a very good ability to grow through periods of extreme volatility. Another part of why we think it's cheap is that the current valuation reflects concerns that AI could erode the value of its financial data-rich platforms. But if you sort of look under the hood, 90% of its database is proprietary and sits behind licensing and permissioning. And that makes it actually inaccessible to AI, public AI models. So we think LSEG's data advantage makes it a net beneficiary of AI because it can synthesize that data a lot better. But it's also signed a recent partnership with AI startup Anthropic, and that sort of underscores that AI is more likely to become a customer of LSEG's data and not a competitor. So going forward, we think LSEG is a competitively advantaged data business that's being misunderstood by the market, and we think that misunderstanding gives you a great business at a reasonable price.
Yeah, exchanges are great businesses, and I like your point. I hadn't realized that. It does make them a customer rather than someone who's just going to have their stuff stolen, their data is sort of used by the AI. The other local picks, because I can tell people are keen, Optasia, Volterra, and Blue Label is a wild card. Sean, appreciate the time. Sean Kurvawell, anchor, thank you very much for the early morning. The Stanlib Flexible Income Fund delivers capital preservation and consistent top quartile inflation-beating returns. Let your money keep working with Stanlib Asset Management even after you retire.
MoneyWeb now, on the money.
Chatting now with Brendan de Jong. He is Head of Global Investment Strategy at PMX. Brendan, always appreciate the early morning. The sort of joke out there, although it's quite serious. Economists have predicted 12 of the last 3 recessions. We love predictions. We're very bad at it. If we go back to the beginning of the year, the predictions were dire. Tariffs were going to bring global recession, stagflation, weak dollar, but here we are in December of 2025, and we are actually all fine and dandy, and none of that has happened.
Yeah, exactly, Simon, and thank you very much for the opportunity. So I think silly season comes with a lot more than golf days and end of year functions and client events and the like. It also seems to be the time when asset managers take out their crystal balls and start telling us what they think is going to happen in the year to come. And yeah, the thing is I think the reliability and the probability of getting these things right, particularly over a 12-month period, is actually very, very low. If you start thinking about the things that need to happen sequentially in order for that prediction, I guess, to come true, and those multiplicative probabilities start making it a very, very low probability of you actually getting it right. And as you point out, quite a few of the predictions that were made come the end of 2024 regarding 2025 turned out to be quite far off the mark. And I think particularly when it comes to global growth, inflation spiking due to tariffs, etc., and a lot of these things didn't actually transpire as what people were predicting.
And it is. I mean, yeah, it's immensely hard. I mean, there are so many data points. There are so many things moving. You can get a lot right, but not get the actual ultimate outcome right. But we do it because we would like certainty in a market. And I'm saying markets, global markets across assets, where actually uncertainty reigns. But we would love to get some certainty, even though, frankly, it is not something we're going to achieve.
Exactly. I think we as humans in general, we crave that certainty, and we'll almost grab any narrative that will provide that, irrespective of whether it is correct or not. And so we'll seek out the narrative that we think makes sense, even though there's a very low probability of it being right. And I think we need to be careful about that, because ultimately the real risk or danger is once these kinds of predictions start playing a central role or theme within the way in which you build your investment portfolio and your investment strategy. And that's when you start getting whipsawed around based off of headlines as opposed to your long-term strategy.
And whipsawed was exactly the word that was coming to my mind, because it is a case of, I mean, you know, investing at its core is actually moderately simple. I mean, it's around diversification. It's around sort of matching your risk and time horizons and sort of staying invested. I mean, this isn't rocket science, but we managed to, as you say, get whipsawed rather than sticking to the basics.
Yes, exactly. And I think the problem also lies in you have very, very convincing storytellers that drive certain narratives, and they are very, very believable. And so we fall into this trap all the time. And so it really does require you to take a step back and think about it more strategically and focus on the long term, what the strategy is, what your goals are, even your own financial personality itself, and how that fits into your overall plan and remaining focused on these core things, because you need to once again come back to the things that you actually can control, and it typically comes down to those kinds of things, understanding your personal circumstances and then also your behavior.
Yeah, and then it comes to and I'm thinking here, particularly in the doomsayers, and there does seem to be a part of the prediction market which is sort of, you know, the doomsayer part of the market. And then the question is, what if they're wrong? I personally know people who went into cash back in April and have done, you know, it has hurt their long-term wealth creation as a result, because the doomsayers were wrong. That's an important question to always put out there.
Yeah, exactly. I think with any prediction or forecast, there's actually a range of possibilities out there and paths too. And so, once again, is if you start building your portfolios around one particular view, that's one of potentially very, very many. And that's how you can run yourself into problems. I think the only way in which you can really combat that is be a little bit modest about ultimately these kinds of predictions. Realize that they're mere opinions and not necessarily scripts or instruction manuals to follow, and build your portfolio that can be resilient through any path that ultimately transpires over the next 3, 5, 10 years, because that's really how you can start compounding those returns and reach your objectives.
Yeah, and it's that resilience and a reminder that no one can see into the future. We leave it there. Brendan de Jong, Head of Global Investment Strategy, PMX. Appreciate the time. Paul today is chatting with Brendan. Forecasting, do you like it? Do you use them? Do you think they're silly? Have your vote, have your say. LinkedIn and Twitter. Give you money, smoother returns for StanLib Asset Management. The StanLib Flexible Income Fund's agile investment process preserves and grows capital in all markets.
MoneyWeb now, on the money.
I'm chatting with Victor Gimmershuizen. He is Senior Investment Banker, ABSA CIB. Victor, back in September, Bidvest issued a Eurobond. I want to dig into some of the details around it, but big picture, this is a fairly big deal. This is not a very common occurrence for South African corporates.
We're very pleased as ABSA CIB to be involved in taking Bidvest to the international markets again, their first time since 2021. And as you say, quite a rare occurrence when it comes to South African corporates going offshore. We have a couple of miners, a couple of telecoms names that have historically accessed the international bond markets. But Bidvest, you know, one of the few, shall we call it, generalized corporates in the country who have done so. And I must say, did so quite successfully.
That success is a big part of it. I mean, 5.5 times oversubscribed. I mean, that means massive demand. And I imagine it also means good pricing for the bond.
Yes, absolutely. So good quality, real money demand. And it really was from across the spectrum. It was your typical, we call them, emerging market buyers out of the UK, the US as well, you know, some pockets of demand out of the Middle East and Asia as well. But then we also had the crossover with the more traditional US high yield buyers, which is always helpful just to big up the demand because they do recognize high quality companies. But then, of course, not to be forgotten, the South African investor base actually really did come to play quite meaningfully in it. I think in a post-Reg 28 world, we do see them selectively supporting the right names out of South Africa with their deployment of their international allowances. And they really did come in size and allow for a very good pricing outcome for Bidvest. And that pricing outcome, the way that we benchmark it is how do they price relative to where the South African sovereign sort of our essential risk-free rate for South African issuers, how do they price relative to that? And at the time, it was just 40 basis points over the South African sovereign. So that worked out to 6.2% in yield terms. Now, granted, this is a dollar yield, so not perfectly comparable to their rand yields, but 40 basis points over the sovereign for a sub-investment grade name is an astonishingly good outcome.
Well, historically, what would a corporate have got? Because, I mean, 40 basis points seems minusculely tiny. What would have sort of been the average in leading up to this issuance?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of names, and unfortunately, they will mostly be resource heavy when we look at them. If you think of the Sabanyes, of the Sassels of the world, you're in the 200 plus basis points types area. Sappi, probably a little bit tighter, although to be fair, where Bidvest is a, shall we call it 25% South Africa, 25% international, 75% South Africa. Sappi is essentially the inverse in terms of earnings, which is, so it is viewed as a more international name and less kind of linked directly to that South African sovereign. So Sappi, I think, is the one name that would have priced around these levels. But yeah, I think, you know, typically in the 200s is where we would often see names priced.
In terms of accessing the Eurobond market, I mean, is it, obviously there's reporting, but I mean, Bidvest has got reporting structures, there's legal work and stuff. Is it vastly difficult, more complex, more effort than a local issuance?
It's absolutely more effort. But what I would say, where the South African, particularly if we're looking at JSE top 40, top 100 type names, is that the nature of our reporting standards are so good in this country that a lot of it can be transposed across. There is quite an extensive due diligence process that sits behind it, a lot of ticking and tying numbers back and making sure that it is up to international standard and that auditors have been through everything and checked it all, as well as the lawyers. But the first biggest piece of the work being that disclosure, I think, is largely done. And for our best names, porting it across into the offering document isn't too much work. There are two other aspects, I suppose, which really do make up the bulk of the complexity in this. And that would be what we call the risk factors, which is really thoroughly describing what could all go wrong. And then, of course, you know, justifications as to why it wouldn't. And then the third element would be the structuring of the actual instrument. Now, you may recall in the good old investment grade South Africa days, names like an MTN could issue without covenants, without too much in terms of restricting or limiting covenants and structures around their notes. Now that we are firmly and have been for some time a sub-investment grade country, our issuers do need those more high-yield type covenant structures. Mm-hmm. So there is quite a bit of work that goes into putting those incurrence-based covenant packages together, getting both the company's head around it, not particularly in this case, this wasn't their debut, but just making sure it is fit for purpose, that you have covenants that are in place to give the balancing act of investors receive the comfort they need that this company is not going to lever itself up to 10 times, but also allowing the business enough bandwidth and latitude to keep growing as it needs to. And particularly in the case of Bidvest, this has really been one of the successful offshore acquisition stories, where they've bought no single large, we call it, transformative offshore acquisition assets. They've bought a series of well-priced, well-executed niche businesses that match well to their sort of operational know-how, maintaining in many cases the existing management, just bringing their expertise over the top, and crucially into developed markets. So they are buying in the likes of Ireland, the UK, most recently Canada and the US, Australia. So you've got this double B rated issuer buying into single A territories, and really over time upgrading, you know, if while, you know, there are dollars of earnings and dollars of earnings, and these become higher quality dollars in an investor's mind because they are from earnings from better rated regions.
Gotcha. Of course, that is absolutely an important point. We'll leave it there. That's Victor Chumahazen. He is Senior Investment Banker, Absa CIB. Appreciate the time. That's it for today. Our poll yesterday, we were chatting with Chantal Marks, talking banks. They had a decent 2025. What about next year? And asked you what you thought. Half said yes, looking good. 40% said yes, some of them are looking good. And the rest said nope, you have concerns. Have your vote, have your say, LinkedIn and Twitter. This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more certainty to navigate volatile market conditions. We're live every weekday morning, the MoneyWeb website and the app, 6:30 a.m. podcast just after 7. Thanks to my team, Eddie, Nubokle, Nicole, to you for listening, my guests for their time. My name is Simon Brown. This is MoneyWeb Now. We'll chat again tomorrow. Super apps.
You've been listening to another MoneyWeb Now podcast, posted every weekday at 7 a.m. on moneyweb.co.za. MoneyWeb Now. On the money.